Good afternoon, everyone, and thank you for having us here to share some work that we've been doing at the University of Canberra around open access and open academia that we'd like to share with you and get your response to. The notes and the slides for this presentation are all available on the web from tinyurl.com/openkca. So you can follow things up. Lee Blackall is, we're both in the Faculty of Health. Lee works in sport and he works as the Learning Commons Coordinator. And myself, I teach in the Centre for Applied Psychology. So we're very much at the coalface, but what we've been doing is trying to extract some of the general principles from our work at the coalface and then working back up the university hierarchy to have discussions about how we can adapt policy and practice to embrace the opportunities that are now on the horizon around open licensing of academic materials. So our presentation is in the public domain, so you're free to grab any of this and reuse it elsewhere. We want to acknowledge that we've been invited to talk here on behalf of the University of Canberra's Office of Development and Engagement, and we've got a third colleague here, Lewis, with us as well. Okay, so I'll take 10 minutes or so just to offer you some of the philosophical thinking and principles behind this kind of paradigm-shifting notion of open academia. We'll give you a couple of examples of what it might look like in practice, and then Lee's going to talk to you about the initiatives that we've got at the University of Canberra in terms of engaging and networking and getting the university and our colleagues on board with the proposals. So a little bit of, I guess, going back to think about what a university is, what it's here for, and what kind of role it plays in our culture and society. And if you go and look at most universities' mission statements, they're not that different from one another, by and large. And they more or less coalesce around the idea that a university is here to serve a function in society, and ultimately it's to create and develop knowledge, and then to disseminate and share that knowledge with society. Now, for us, we're going to talk about these some principles, but making sure that these are applicable at the coalface is just as important. And so we want to try and talk to you about how some of the problems and practices of putting this into application. One of our starting points is to acknowledge and recognise that the vast majority of content and knowledge that we work with at universities is underutilised and it's rarely ever seen to commercial application, much as Scott's graphs just showed. So we're as interested, I guess, in capitalising on the uncommercialisable content, at least in a traditional sense, by saying rather than lock it up and hide it away, what would happen to a university and what would happen to a society if we unlocked that material and made it much more readily available, and that this may represent a way for universities to have a deeper level of dynamic engagement with its community. What we're suggesting is also that by opening up materials and intellectual capital at universities, that we will also contribute to that small amount of knowledge that does get commercialised, because the university and the community will get to know what knowledge the university has much more readily. At the moment it's in dusty folders and personal hard drives and so on. If we could see more of it and access more of it and network with more of it, then it will contribute to that frisson of ideas, some of which can then bubble up to have commercial application. So we see our role as academics as being part of a collaborative knowledge commons, building that commons and sharing and disseminating that knowledge commons. We see this as a reciprocal relationship. So the taxpayer for public-funded institutions provides the resources, the infrastructure and the operating costs for a university, and in return, the university's role is to share back its discoveries and its knowledge and offer training and ways to access and that knowledge. And we see that public-funded universities in particular, of all places, should actually be championing this knowledge sharing and access to scholarly resources, much as we expect of a library or our public service sector. Public universities should also be out there contributing significantly to this. So our approach then is coming, I guess, from the philosophical position of how do we maximise sharing and access to knowledge, as opposed to what we would probably argue is the normative practice within universities, which is to minimise sharing and to meter it out very slowly. If you pay for a course, we will give you hard copies of materials and we'll restrict everything else as much as possible and so on. So we're inviting you to entertain the idea of what would a university look like that took on this kind of approach. So it really comes down to this dilemma that you're all facing every day, and that is, for any particular piece of content, how do you negotiate and decide whether to share or protect that material and whether to promote it out into the world or restrict access to it? The proposal that we're going to put to you, and Lee's going to expand on this, is a conversation that's being had by many governments at the moment, and that is that perhaps for those institutions and services that are fundamentally public funded, we flip the switch from the default being closed to the default being open. And then if we do want to restrict something and close it off, that's okay, but we want to have a particular reason for doing that, and otherwise we would make the information as accessible and open as possible. So let's now have a look at how we've been approaching these kinds of ideas in practice. We're starting with this idea that openness represents a theoretical component to authentic scholarship, authentic scientific scholarship. And indeed, openness is pretty key to that. If you submit an article to a journal, the idea is that it gets peer-reviewed and then gets put out for public consultation, that data should be verifiable, that there's been due process and ethics in the research process, etc. So this principle seems to be very much inherent in actually what constitutes scholarship as opposed to private opinion. The philosophy is really quite simple, but in practice it gets kind of gnarly and complicated, and that's probably why many of us do the jobs that we do. At any point then, there is that decision whether you're the knowledge creator or whether you come into possession of intellectual property to effectively turn left or right. Now, there are shades of grey in between, but fundamentally it comes down to, is your attitude to the knowledge to go down the closed, restricted path or the open path? Normative practice in universities is largely closed. So we have, to various extents, restricted access of materials, restricted copyright licences. We tend to use proprietary formats for our digital files, whereas you'll notice now many governments are switching over to open formats for their files, and that's linked with then requiring proprietary software to access those archives and files. And fifthly up there, the governance processes involved in how the knowledge is managed is often somewhat opaque. In taking the journey towards open academia, then we can turn each of these things around and suggest that these might be some pillars or principles that we need to think about and apply. So our digital files being stored in open formats that can be accessed with open source software, openly licensed materials unless there's a particularly good commercial reason or ethical reason to close them off, having transparent governance, making the materials openly accessible such that you can use free software to access those files. So a couple of examples of what this might look like on the ground. This is an important announcement, if you're not aware of it, that the Australian Federal Government, as of last month, took on the recommendations of the Government 2.0 Task Force, and within that, the Federal Government has flipped the switch on public service information. And the IP policy now states that public sector information should be licensed under the Creative Commons by standard as the default. And it goes on to say, you know, if you don't want to license it or there's a reason not to, then you go through a negotiation process around the license to be applied. Now, the Australian government is not the first. New Zealand has gone, and several of the European countries have already gone this way or are heading this way. So if that's the signal coming from our federal government, you'll notice that the funding grant bodies are increasingly requiring data to be openly available once you've done your grant and that your materials that are disseminated to be in the public domain, then I guess it invites the universities to think about how they're going to respond accordingly. One of the examples that we probably are all somewhat familiar with is the journals and the textbooks that we use in teaching. So typically what happens is that the public will fund universities to do research to write articles. We then give away the rights, generally to a proprietary journal, and the member of the public must then pay again to access that article. And as a member of the public who's paid your taxes for the universities to do the research, you might be left thinking, what did I get out of that when it's so difficult to get access to the information? So increasingly the open journals and the internet are becoming an alternative, and many academics will submit to the journal and then try and renegotiate the rights so that they can put it up on the internet. There's no particular reason why the knowledge shouldn't be available to the public. Textbook prices have doubled in relation to inflation over the past couple of decades. In the course that I taught this semester, we couldn't find an appropriate textbook. There wasn't an Australian textbook, and it wasn't covering the topics we needed. So instead of having students write essays, they wrote an open textbook. So in 3 months, we've developed a 700-page textbook on the topic that is openly and readily available, and we'll print and sell that book at half the cost. Then the third example, Lee, do you want to come up at this point? Lee's been working on the IP policy previously at Otago Polytechnic, and Lee, do you want to come up and talk from here? He'll talk about the third example and then our policy proposal for the university.
Thanks, James. Just to clarify, I didn't particularly write the IP policy at Otago Polytechnic, but I lobbied on this principle, and the people who wrote the IP policy took on board some of it. This was a project funded by the Ministry of Education in New Zealand. We wanted to somehow come up with a return on investment to quantify what return there is for an academic or a lecturer at the Polytechnic who understood intellectual property in terms of open practice, but also used the popular social media to practice their teaching and, in some cases, their research. We figured that it cost us $4,000 one-on-one training with staff member to understand how to use the internet to a sophisticated level. And through savings and gains, they returned $8,000 in the first year. That's when we looked at, say, marketing would spend this much on a billboard and a newspaper ad. The lecturer has produced a instructional video on how to make a lemon meringue pie was one example, and it's received 60,000 views on YouTube. So we just made a correlation between how much marketing spend to get cars not looking up at the billboard driving past compared to people actually clicking and watching the YouTube video, giving feedback, suggestions, and actually other universities and polytechnics contacting that particular school and talking about a collaboration and student exchange project. Okay, so the Open UC proposal is in progress. It's made up of four components, one of which I'm going to talk about today, which is the IP proposal. But it's we'll be working on making sure that if that proposal is taken on board in some way, that we have detailed the procedures for the business and service units to complement that, that the education and research policy encourages that sort of practice and rewards and recognises that sort of practice, and indeed so does the performance review process. That was a mistake we made at Otago Polytechnic. We only focused on the intellectual property policy, didn't get everything else in line. It just became a policy nobody ever read. Okay. Here are the four components of the proposed IP policy. I'm not a lawyer, I'm not an IP lawyer, and no one involved so far in this is an IP lawyer. We've simply used the network, the internet network, to comment and make recommendations, and the latest legal eyes to look at it was the National Union for the Academics, NTEU. Their lawyer looked at it and gave it a glowing response, so we're off to a good step from their perspective anyway. So I've spoken to Charlie Day at the Melbourne University after when I briefly mentioned the points of the IP policy proposal at my back table, and it was told to me that Melbourne University tried assigning IP to their staff and students and it failed, and I wanted to know the detail to that because that's what we're proposing. I think if the thing I've struggled to understand is that if a university or any other institution claims ownership over the products or knowledge that's generated by their employees, then naturally, if I was an employee, anything I came up with was in the shower, at home, when I was on holiday. I didn't do it in my work time, especially if I start to get into a bad relationship with my supervisor. And I don't think you need to look far to find those sorts of examples or conversations. And also, I have I've currently worked at the University of Canberra for a little over 1 year now, so I bring with me a whole bunch of contacts and knowledge and products and ideas, and so I'm not sure if I would have to surrender all of that. So I'm not sure that the institution claiming the rights of the IP generated simplifies the process, unless, of course, your only people you're dealing with are only employees and have been working on their projects 100% of the time under your institution. So apart from the bad will that it might generate to make such a claim, I think to invert it and to say all staff own their intellectual property is a good gesture, particularly for an institute like the University of Canberra, who's only just making steps towards research. But the second part of the proposal, I think, is the interesting trigger for those in the room who are not convinced by that argument. I think the problem, particularly on yesterday's morning scenario of that legacy of complexity that we had to deal with on a general scenario, I think it was 11 years in total, was created because at the outset a trigger wasn't initiated with an intellectual property support office at their institution. That was only occurred at the end of the process, or when somebody realised they might have had a commercial entity in hand, and then they went and contacted their IT intellectual property office and then unfurled all of that complexity they had to untangle. So what we're saying is that if you use the University of Canberra as a platform to publish your intellectual property, a lectern recording system, a learning management system, which is an online website thing, we'd have to find out the detail of this. The default is to Creative Commons attribution. That awards the university able to take a copy, anyone else is able to take a copy. It affords us a lot of opportunity gains, such as the one I mentioned with the Otago Polytechnic, getting contact by other institutions to talk about collaborative and student exchange projects. But if there's a problem with that, then you opt out. And that opt out is the trigger to the Intellectual Property Office. And I think that would potentially solve or at least give the Intellectual Property Office more accurate triggers to then go into an intervention with their academics. How the detail of that? I mean, one example is that the screen interface is when I'm uploading a video to YouTube, for example. This is one suggestion we've made to our IT department. When I'm uploading a video to YouTube that expresses a project or an idea that we're working on, what I really want is that video to also copy across to my library archive, to the National Archive, the National Library if they'll have it, and to a couple of other video sharing sites. And there isn't a tool that enables me to spread that video across all of those, but of course if the university came up with such a tool and then added a little drop-down that says what copyright are you going to apply, and that automates a trigger to the Intellectual Property Office, then I think at least in terms of the online realm, you've given a service that's very valuable to somebody who wants to distribute their information out and put in a little trigger that will initiate the Intellectual Property Office. So if you want to opt out of the Creative Commons attribution default from the Institute, then you have to make contact and discuss, and that discussion might be educative or commercialization process. And the other one that I learnt from New Zealand, to my knowledge, there isn't an Australian intellectual property policy that recognises Indigenous autonomy on the notion. In New Zealand, this is common. And I think as complex as that would be for us, it would be nice to be part of an institution that made the first steps in this direction, perhaps using the New Zealand experience as a guide. So that's the intellectual property policy, one part. I'll just go back, one part of four parts. In response to James Neal, a researcher and teacher, how do we come up with a policy that recognises his practice and encourages it to become the norm, so that the majority of the intellectual property or activity that's going on in the university is exposed and the minority that it might have commercial value is still potentially protected. So the discussion points is just repeating what James said. They have vast amounts of unrealised intellectual property, intellectual capital. Could this be a way to capitalise on that so, as yet uncapitalised? And does a protectionist stance justify these lost opportunities by defaulting to all rights are reserved, and to require username and password to see educational materials? What is the value of that lost opportunity? The person who wasn't motivated to get the login or didn't have the $20,000 fee to access the course, and etc. And the proposed IP policy, we hope, gives a more reliable trigger to an intellectual property office who wanted to offer service. I think that must be over time, is it?
I've just got a question about open access and ownership of copyright. A little while ago, a couple of weeks ago, one of the directors of one of our institutes, I'm at La Trobe University, contacted me. They'd been publishing papers on their website that had been presented by people all around the place at various colloquia and seminars organised by this institute. And this attracted the attention of the National Library of Australia, that really wanted to put these papers in a repository. And the library said, we'll put this in our repository if you give us a royalty-free, non-exclusive, perpetual license to the papers. And the director said, can we do this? Well, what do you think we had to say? We can't, because we don't own the copyright.
Yes.
You have to go and ask every one of these people, every one of these authors, to either give you a license or the university a license or assign copyright before we can help the National Library put this on open access in its repository. Mm.
That was a National Library requirement.
Yes.
It would be interesting for us to look into, because I would imagine that they're moving in a similar direction to the federal government kind of licensing. I guess it's those kind of points of friction which cascade right down and eventually becomes kind of gridlock in universities, and doesn't encourage the entrepreneurial and intellectual kind of spirit that that ideally should be up and down the corridors and around the campus. Yeah, so I didn't know about that.
A question regarding the metrics for your research outputs. Because if you go open source, is there any thing which is where you're thinking of how to get this into the ERA system, for example? Because for my knowledge, this is quite outside of normal metrics, how universities get rewarded by the government for research output. Mm. So it's a really important thing how to consider that.
I'm guessing it's only a matter of time before we see more sophisticated metrics come in, whether it's website hits or that sort of thing. I mean, at the moment, they're relatively primitive. It's number of publications, and if you're lucky, citation rates. But I don't know that even citation rates are really registering yet in performance reviews and so on. But, yeah, we would hope that we could get far more sophisticated metrics, not only about how much access, but about what kind of access people are making to the material.
And